Welcome to the Youth Critic Retrospectives on the Youth Critic Network. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Youth Critic Retrospectives. I am your host, Kale Smith. Joining me today is Richard Newby from Hollywood Reporter.
Hey, Kale. Thanks for having me.
So, Richard, what are we talking about today on the Youth Critic Retrospectives?
We are talking about young Sherlock Holmes.
I beg of you, begin an investigation.
Based on what?
Your imagination.
It was obviously a suicide.
Never trust the obvious.
Uncle didn't kill himself.
Before a lifetime of adventure came the adventure of a lifetime.
What's your name?
Holmes. Sherlock Holmes.
It was a girl.
Brilliant deduction, Watson.
Steven Spielberg presents Young Sherlock Holmes.
Yes. So this is the quote-unquote, like, forgotten, lower tier, like, of the Spielberg films, or the Amblin cycle, and I think it's important to talk about this because we think of that the year of Spielberg 85, like, his big, like, coming out as a producer after producing Gremlins and then directing Temple of Doom the year before, but this was the one out of... I don't remember if Color Purple was a flop or anything, but I know that Back to the Future and Goonies were two hits, and then this one actually drastically underperformed in comparison to the Goonies and Back to the Future. So I kind of want to, and I'm trying to understand why, but Richard, starting with you, do you have a theory as to why Young Sherlock Holmes underperformed?
I mean, I think it is a little bit long for its target audience, especially when you're comparing it to something like The Goonies in a similar kind of adventure film. I think this one does drag a little bit in terms of pacing. But, you know, I also wonder if, you know, it doesn't really have any major American stars. And I'm not sure like how big the cast was in the UK either. You know, based on what I've looked at IMDb, like none of them were major stars. So, you know, that could have been an aspect. You know, there's not really a huge draw other than fans of Sherlock Holmes. And again, that's kind of like, especially like in the 80s, you know, Sherlock Holmes is something that is mostly associated with older, you know, audiences. I think, you know, the Hammer films were pretty recent, and the BBC productions, but I don't think that it was necessarily something that, you know, a younger audience of, you know, people wanting to go out and see 80s blockbusters, I don't think that Sherlock Holmes was immediately something they go like, oh, well, this will be a great, you know, movie to see on Friday night.
Well... So right, and I agree with all that, but I think also the problem that Spielberg and everyone had at Paramount was that it was always going to draw a comparison to Indiana Jones because it's an adventure series, and I don't quite think Paramount knew what they had with the movie. And on top of that, you have to. On top of, you know, unknown stars, you have almost unknown or upcoming writer directors as well. You have Chris Columbus, who had just come off of The Goonies a few months prior, but also you have Barry Levinson, who is just off of smaller films like The Natural and Diner. So it was kind of a hard movie to market. And then on top of that, it opened the weekend after Rocky IV. I know Rocky IV also wasn't, I don't think it was as huge of a hit as Rocky III, but it was still a huge hit and continued to run. And then afterwards, I mean, December 1985, I believe, had it was a very busy December too. And this was the start of, and it came out like the first weekend of December. So I think that's why the movie didn't do so well. And also, I believe Spielberg also had another completely other movie that came out right around this time too, with the Color Purple. So go ahead.
Yeah, that came out December 18th. So yeah, they would have been in the theaters at the same time.
So I think it just was a too packed. And also it didn't help that the reception was kind of cool on this. Like a lot of Sherlock Holmes, some of the vibe I got from Sherlock Holmes fans was, or from this time, was that it was not as cerebral or the mystery wasn't as, you know, it wasn't as, you know, intriguing enough as other Sherlock Holmes mysteries. And even, you know, Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel both had reviews that pointed out that kind of the special effects kind of were unnecessary and kind of took over the story. So in, I think it was Siskel's quote that was, you know, while the technical aspects are fantastical, it's the, you know, the villain here is not worthy of Watson and Holmes's like sleuthing. So I think the response was just, it's okay. And I think that's what kind of, you know, petered the movie, with no stars, a cool reception, and then just a bunch of other movies coming out at that time. I think that's what it was. But that's neither here or there. What do you think of the movie overall?
I actually quite enjoyed the movie. I had really low expectations going in. And so that could be part of it, but I definitely enjoyed it. I really like Chris Columbus as a writer. And I could kind of see, you know, touches here of what he would go on to do with Harry Potter, you know, in terms of the whole, you know, school setting and, you know, the kind of wintry holiday feel and, you know, a mystery that I felt like it's geared towards younger viewers. You know, it's definitely not a Sir Arthur Conan Doyle mystery, but I felt like it was kind of a fun, fantastical mystery, you know, geared towards younger audiences. And I like the special effects aspect of it. So I definitely see why, you know, fans of Sherlock Holmes could take issue with, you know, aspects of the movie, because I do think that it steps, you know, quite a bit away from the source material. But yeah, I thought it was kind of a fun 80s hidden gem.
For me, it's not even that the mystery isn't that, you know, cerebral, as much as, and I think it's going back to your earlier point, I think the pacing is a little too slow for this movie. And I think, because the movie opens with a banger. I mean, it opens with, you know, a man hallucinating that he's being, you know, attacked by his dead chicken.
Yeah.
And then to add to the prologue, he hallucinates again that his whole room is attacking him. And then he jumps out a window and you just get the creepy image of the snow just falling onto him and the shadow just passing through him. And then you cut to the credits. And one of the weirder aspects of the movie, and I don't know how you feel about this, but I really didn't care for the narration. You know, I didn't think we needed the narration. I think Levinson's direction kind of tells the story very well. And I think it's kind of a little clunky, and I don't like it. Just, it comes in at the wrong times, and it kind of almost spoils the movie, because it mentions that Holmes cries twice, and it's one at the funeral and then one later. And then we see him cry again later.
Yeah. That was definitely that definitely spoiled that moment when he said that. I was like, oh well, that takes care of that. Yeah, definitely thought that the narration. I mean, it didn't necessarily take away from the film, but I didn't think that it needed to be there.
Yeah, it's. I mean, it feels very much like someone reading you a book while the movie is showing at the same time. So that's, you know, that's how I kind of felt about it. And so the movie's already kind of working on me because, or it's not working against me because the narration's kind of telling me the story and taking me kind of actively out of it. And then you have, and then the slow burn of like two, like Waxbutter's death. Mm. And, you know, it's all building, but it doesn't get really that interesting until we get to the Egyptian stuff. And then it finally kicks into like gear four and not even, it's like gear four plus the sports mode. And then we're like, oh, okay, this is an adventure story. And now it's exciting. And then we get even more crazier hallucinations.
Yeah.
And that's for me where the story kind of picks up. And then you mentioned the Harry Potter stuff. There's a, like, Columbus basically, either Columbus or Rowling either remembered or saw this movie and took a lot from this in terms of inspiration for at least the first two Harry Potter movies. Because John Williams' score in the Harry Potter films is very similar to Bruce Broughton's score here.
Yeah.
So it's even the character Dudley looks so similar to Malfoy.
He does. Yeah. It's really uncanny. And even our three leads, because, you know, I posted a picture on Twitter, a still from a film when I was watching this. And of you know, Sherlock Watson and I can't remember the female character.
Elizabeth.
I posted a picture and someone said, like, you know, if I didn't know what Harry Potter was, I would just assume that this was Harry Potter. And you know, and even with the villain, you know, it's a teacher at the school who is, you know, moonlighting as the arch nemesis. I mean, there's so many similarities there.
Who ultimately becomes Moriarty.
Yeah. So yeah, I definitely, when I was watching this, I was like, Rowling had to have seen this at some point.
Yeah, I mean, it's just one of those, it's either that or, it's that, and then also, I mean, Columbus just remembered this movie, and he probably felt at the time he didn't get it all correct and what he wanted to do with it, with the script. And most people don't remember, but he originally did actually write drafts for Sorcerer's Stone. Like, he wrote it just as kind of like a pitch to Warner Brothers to say, this is what I would do. This is kind of the tone I'm going for. So I wonder if he kind of took leftover ideas from his Sherlock Holmes script, implied that to that script, and then that's how he got the job.
Yeah, it definitely makes sense. I feel like, you know, there are so many, you know, little touches, and, you know, even some of the scenes, for one, like the scene in the dining hall where they're all kind of sitting at these long tables with candles and all the teachers are in the front, you know, sitting all together. You know, that's very much like a scene out of the main hall in Harry Potter. So I do think that he's definitely, you know, went on to kind of say, well, I can, you know, perhaps do it better, you know, perfect my pacing, you know, and have better special effects with Harry Potter, but kind of, you know, touch on the same kind of feelings that I wanted to elicit with young Sherlock Holmes.
Mm-hmm. And then even better, have a better mystery for each of his movies. 'Cause the mysteries that, I mean, and granted, you know, Columbus is using Rowling's stories for his movies. and a lot of the bases were already there for it. But still, like, it's whatever Columbus, you know, didn't get right in Young Sherlock Holmes, he got it exceptionally right in the Harry Potter movies. Like, the problem I have with Young Sherlock Holmes, the Elizabeth character, you know, kind of not being as strong, or, you know, having a lot of agency, and kind of even being more of a tool or foil for the boys. It gets in Harry Potter, it gets better with Hermione. It's
for sure.
So, you know, I think Columbus found his young Sherlock Holmes much 15 years later, 16 years later.
Yeah, I 100% agree with that.
Mm-hmm. And what's even more interesting is, you know, you brought up the teacher thing. In each of the Harry Potter movies, it's a teacher that Harry likes or admires. Yeah. So, of course, I should have seen it ahead of time. I didn't see that the villain was Higgins' character the whole time. But I should have seen it knowing that, oh, because I had already put together all the Harry Potter connections. And then I was like, oh, yeah, of course it makes sense. The headmaster or this guy is a, you know, of course it makes sense.
Yeah.
And it's a defense teacher.
Yeah, that's true too.
Defense. Yeah. It's, wow. Young J.K. Rowling ripped off young Sherlock Holmes. Wow. That should be the tweet of the day. Someone should just tweet that. That might be the title of this podcast. J.K. Rowling ripped off young Sherlock Holmes. So one of the striking things I really liked was the cinematography from Stephen Colblatt, who for many Batman fans, he did the Joel Schumacher Batman movies. He worked with Columbus recently on Rent. Well, not recently, but Rent, Percy Jackson, and has done the Lethal Weapon movies. And one of the things I've noticed in this movie, you know, in comparing to the lighting and all those other movies, is there's a very strong, like, backlit with fog in the light.
Yeah.
And I've been seeing a couple of videos lately of, like, people discussing cinematographers' work, like their styles, which most people wouldn't think that would be a thing, because you know, people still think that auteur theory is that everything services the one auteur.
Right.
But I'm starting to think that cinematographers are implementing or hiding their styles in each of their films. And I think Colblatt's style is very much present here. And then you can kind of trace it in other films after this, especially in the Joel Schumacher Batman movies. If you look at those films visually and compare this to young Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. I think it's a gorgeous looking film. I love the backlit fog. You know, the night scenes in particular in young Sherlock Holmes are just, like, really cool looking. And then, you know, when you head into the finale, I feel like that's just, like, such a great looking, you know, set piece and scene with that cinematography, with the snow and the fog and the darkness. I mean, I feel like it's really masterful cinematography.
Mm-hmm. What else struck to you about the film?
I really like the production design, especially when you get into the temple. You know, I love big set pieces, and I feel like, you know, that's such a cool looking space. And then when the fire starts, and, you know, Watson has to pull Sherlock up and, like, rig up this pulley system. You know, I think that's just, like, it's such cool stuff. And that, I think, is where it feels the most Spielbergian to me. You know, when you get into these kind of, like, Rube Goldberg contraptions within this adventure. So that was something that really impressed me. And then the graveyard scene, you know, going back to, you know, some of the visions that the characters see. You know, and I read that some people who saw this as a kid, they said that this was like pure like kinder trauma for them, that they had nightmares about that graveyard scene and those baked goods that become sentient and attack Watson. But stuff like that, I mean, it's very much like not what you would expect from Sherlock Holmes, but I thought that it was a lot of fun and just, you know, really, really interestingly done.
Right. For me, you know, what's so great about those visions that in the graveyard scene is, you know, you get Watson with the pastries, and then that gets paid off later when Watson gets a French pastry and talks to it. And it's like, I bet you have nothing to say to me, and I have nothing to say to you. And what's really interesting is when we see Holmes's vision, and basically it's just very implied that Holmes caught his father cheating on his mother. Yeah. That's the implication. And again, not to bring in Spielberg's whole divorce thing, but that feels like the Spielberg, like somebody giving Spielberg a little, you know, hey, here's your main character who also has divorced parents or parents going through a trying time. And I don't remember what much about Elizabeth. I just remember her falling in like a grave.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a fear of her own demise. You know, that's kind of interesting because that's the one that does actually happen at the end of the movie. So it's kind of a bit of a foreshadowing there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think for her, you know, and that's one of the more cynical endings of the film. To me, it just feels so cynical because also I don't think that's the right, I don't know, there's just something wrong with that ending. It just doesn't feel right.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's very tragic, I feel like, especially for, you know, a movie associated with Spielberg where I feel like young love tends to triumph. And here it's cut short. So on one hand, I understand because, you know, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes is said to be, you know, emotionless, and they want to show, you know, how did he become this person who closed himself off to feeling. But yes, at the same time, I feel like it doesn't necessarily fit with what you expect from Levinson or Spielberg or Columbus. So it's these two, you know, conflicting ideas of trying to create a path to the Sherlock Holmes that audiences are familiar with, but also, you know, trying to make a movie that, you know, can be spoken of in the same terms as the Goonies or an Indiana Jones. So yeah, I feel like there's a contradiction, I think, in terms of the material there.
Well, I have a quote pulled up from Chris Columbus, but here's what he kind of said about the romantic side plot. The thing that was most important to me was why Holmes became so cold and calculating, and why he was alone for the rest of his life. That's why he is so emotional in the film. As a youngster, he was ruled by emotion. He fell in love with the love of his life, and as a result of what happens in this film, he becomes the person he was later. So I think for Columbus, and then maybe Levinson, Spielberg, they all kind of realized that was going to be an emotional tie. The origin story part of it was, how does this person become so cold and calculating? And to use Elizabeth, who already kind of is, you know, she kind of already feels like a tool in this movie. Like, she just kind of feels like she's just there, and not with very, and just feels with very little agency. She, it doesn't, I don't, that's one of the weakest parts in the movie for me. And then, of course, you know, you get the second reveal that he, you know, this is the second time he cried. So, or, and you're just like, oh, that's where it came. So I guess Holmes and Watson, you know, that's where, you know, I guess that's where Watson saw Holmes cry, you know, for the second time and only at a time. So again, it's just one of those, but I am glad the narration didn't come back in and was like, and this was the second time I saw him cry. yeah. Overall, but yeah. And so what did you, I wasn't really big on that. And, but overall I didn't, but I don't hate the Elizabeth character. I just think that she could have just been better written.
For sure.
She could have been just another, she could have been just like another Watson or something to be helpful, but not just, you know, but just not the dead girl in the fridge.
Yeah, you know, when the movie first started, I thought that she might be the Irene Adler character from the home stories, and I think that might have been, you know, it might have served her character better, because, you know, not only is she not someone who is going to, you know, inevitably die in the end, but also, you know, as you said, has more of her own agency. She's, you know, less of a kind of tag along or even damsel in distress, and more of a, you know, detective in her own rights, you know, different from Holmes and different from Watson, but just as integral to, you know, helping them solve cases.
Absolutely. But yeah. And so what did you think of the big twist as to like why them these five or six men were getting murdered, and now there are these like missing women?
It was definitely, I mean, it's a very silly plot, in terms of, you know, the backstory of this Anglo-Egyptian, you know, coming here and making sacrifices of women because his hometown was destroyed. And then the reveal that one of the school maids is his sister, and who had, you know, lost her hair in the fire. That bald cap though was really something.
All of the ball caps.
Yeah.
All the ball caps in this movie. Just, wow. Very shiny ball caps for your 4K TV.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, that didn't age. That aged perfectly. as I sip this.
But yeah, so it was definitely, it was very silly. Plot. I mean, it didn't, you know, I still ended up liking the movie, but it definitely made me chuckle a little bit. And I'm still not entirely certain of what he hoped to accomplish by, you know, sacrificing the young women, because it's like, man, your city is gone. So I don't know, understand like what you're trying to create here by sacrificing these women. Like, you're not gonna get it back.
I mean, he's a death cultist. What do you expect? and he's a death. And also, that's a weird origin story for Moriarty, because yeah. Moriarty's supposed to be an equal to Holmes in terms of intelligence. And it just, you know, and this origin story for Moriarty. It's just like, yeah, so how's this is revenge that no one seems to care about.
Yeah.
Yay. You got your revenge Why not just kill the why not just kill the 5 or 6 men that led to your village being burned down?
Right.
Yeah, especially since this is, I mean, and if you wanted people to care about it, wouldn't you like make it a much bigger scene? When you, why would you be so inconspicuous about, and why would you be so secretive about it?
Yeah, yeah, it's very much an underground, it's an underground revenge plot. And I thought that maybe it would have worked better if it was a peer of Sherlock Holmes, like a fellow student, you know, rather than someone who's already a full grown man. Because again, going back to what you said about Sherlock and Moriarty being equals, it's like, well, like you can't be an equal to Sherlock Holmes if you got like foiled by like 3 teenagers and you're already maybe like a good like 20-25 years older than them. Maybe you should go back to the drawing books a little bit. So the Moriarty, you know, reveal at the end was cool in terms of like, oh, like I get that reference, like that's interesting. I did like the actor, but in terms of, you know, thinking about Moriarty as Sherlock Holmes's arch nemesis, his origin and his plot definitely doesn't live up to the namesake.
Absolutely. I think it's just, well, it's odd, but also in a weird, in an interesting sense. So Waxfutter, the person that everyone likes at the beginning of the movie, him and his like colleagues, what's interesting about this, so in Spielberg is like running a series of about archaeological digging, right? Or about an archaeologist, right? With Indiana Jones. And this movie's like the people that were like the catalyst of this whole revenge plot are a bunch of archaeologists. So is like Columbus and Levinson like having this like anti-colonial / archaeological stance in the middle of their young Sherlock Holmes movie produced by the guy that's making the most successful archaeologist movie franchise ever?
Yeah, that's an interesting point.
Because that's kind of what the background is on that, is that they were archaeologists, they got caught in a situation. British troops came in and, you know, burned the village down. Very similar to what happens at the end of Temple of Doom, by the way. So it's like all these people like, are these filmmakers like, did they watch Temple of Doom and was like, yes, that's what happens at the end. That's a bad thing. And that's what's going to cause this. That's what's going to cause some, that's what's going to, you know, basically be a, and it's a bad thing. I was just kind of reading into that. Like, oh my God, Spielberg produced a movie about Spielberg produced a movie that was kind of running against his franchise.
Yeah. Yeah. That's definitely, it's an interesting point. Yeah. And I'm not sure that it necessarily gets the full exploration that it deserves. But I do think that that's an interesting point, you know, to come from someone who, you know, as you said, has made the most successful archaeology movies of all time.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and I know I know it's sort of reaching, but it's just one of those, it was just an interesting thing that came up in the movie. And I was like, wait a minute. British troops burning down a village in Egyptian? While saving these like five white archaeologists? That's interesting.
Yeah.
Gonna put that in the note somewhere. But yes, so, but that's the thing I took away. I don't think it earns it because, again, the villain's whole revenge plot is kind of dumb. Like, so you're gonna burn the, why not just kill, what happened to the other 5 princesses that were, you know, dug up? Were they burned in the village too? What happened? So it's just one of those weird, it's a weird revenge subplot, but it's a very 80s revenge subplot.
It is. Yeah. And I think that's part of why I just kind of like took it in stride. I mean, this is very 80s. I mean, if they tried to pull this off, you know, today, I'd be like, no way. But, you know, certain things in the 80s, I just kind of accept. And it's like, yeah, this is very much of its time.
Well, that and all of our friends would just like be howling and laughing about it. So that's why it wouldn't necessarily work today. Back then, it kind of just goes, it kind of just flows under the river. So, you know, so yeah. What else? So, what else is there to say about young Sherlock Holmes?
Well, we touched on this a little bit earlier, but I really do like the score. I like the score a lot. That was probably one of my favorite parts of the movie.
It's really good. And when the movie started and it has that nice little prologue music, I thought it was John Williams. And I was like, oh, finally, like John Williams gets to score one of these movies from 85. Nope. There's some guy named Bruce Broughton, who I believe did the original Hawaii Five-0 theme. And he's a great composer. He's done a lot of like just different stuff. I think his name just doesn't get brought up that often because his stuff kind of is more into TV. But here, like, yeah, it's a great score. Like, it's filled with the mystery. It's filled with the tension. The Ramatep score or cue.
Yeah, that's great.
Intense. It's perfect. Yeah. And it builds on to that, you know, action scene at the end. Or the climactic scene. So it's really great. I don't know why people aren't talking about this score more, because it, along with the, you know, I think this score is better than the one we got from the Goonies.
I agree. Memorable. Yeah, I agree for sure.
I mean, nothing, of course, will beat the Alan Slevdry score for Back to the Future, but, you know, this is a pretty good contender, and I haven't listened to the Color Purple soundtrack yet, so I don't know. So yeah, I don't know where that stands in the Spielberg of 85 scores yet. But with that, like, it is a great score, and you also have to wonder if John Williams also listened to this music, or if Columbus used this score as temp music for the first Harry Potter movie.
Yeah, I could definitely see that.
I wonder, that's what someone needs to ask Columbus while he's doing these Christmas Chronicle 2 interviews.
For sure, yeah.
They need to ask him about this in comparison with Harry Potter. I wonder if we're too late. I wonder if we're too late on that bandwagon. I wonder if they're all done already, but someone just needs to bring that up, you know, like, so someone needs to just talk about young Sherlock Holmes, really.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure there's going to be a Christmas Chronicles 3 because they seem to be very successful. So next time he does the interview circuit, I'm going to try to reach out. Someone who's going to interview him and tell them to ask about your young Sherlock Holmes and Harry Potter.
I think you should, because, well, and also there's just not much about this movie. Like, I don't think there's even a Blu-ray yet for this movie.
There's not. Yeah, I looked for one.
The only 1080p file or 1080p version I have that of this movie is apparently on Amazon Prime. So
yeah.
Let alone there's not a 4K version, so which is funny because both Goonies and Back to the Future this year got 4K 4K Ultra HD versions this year. So
yeah, I'd love to see a collector's company like Shout Factory put out a collector's edition Blu-ray of this. Mm-hmm. Because I definitely think that it would garner more fans now than it did in 85. I definitely feel like there's a lot there that people would enjoy. And I mean, just in terms of film history, you know, with the first fully CGI character, and then, you know, it was also one of the movies that I believe really, you know, led to the PG-13 rating, you know, along with Gremlins and Temple of Doom. This is often cited as one of the things that led to PG-13. So, I mean, from a film history standpoint, I feel like it definitely, you know, also deserves a Blu-ray for that reason.
Absolutely. Well, and yeah, I mean, it's not just film history, but also, I mean, this feels like, you know, Columbus cited this for Harry Potter and even Rowling for her books. So it just feels like this is a perfect movie to do not just with Shout, but also Arrow as well. Or Second Sight, who just did the whole Dawn of the Dead, who just re-released Dawn of the Dead on 4K. Somebody should do this, because I feel like this is the perfect movie to, and while the, you know, actors and directors are still alive, you know, like, have them sit down and talk about the movie and talk about, like, its place. Like, I get that for Spielberg, it's an odd duck, because he really did count. He really did want to do a franchise with these people, or these characters.
Yeah.
So I don't know if he's just like burnt on the Sherlock Holmes or what, but I feel like, you know, someone should like at least give this movie a Blu-ray release. You know, like give this, you know, some proper love, because it just seems way too forgotten, and I don't think it deserves to be forgotten.
Yeah, and I definitely would have watched a franchise of it if one had been made. But I know that the guy who played Sherlock Holmes, Nicholas Rowe, he played a younger version, an adult version of Holmes in that Mr. Holmes movie with Ian McKellen.
Oh, Bill Condon's movie?
Yeah, he plays the fully adult version of Ian McKellen's Holmes. So that's kind of cool that he got to reprise his role as Sherlock Holmes decades later.
That's wonderful. That is wonderful, because I tried to do research to find where like everyone went, where like all these actors went, like Alan Cox, Nicholas Rowe, and then Sophia Bush. I try to find out where all these characters went, or people went, because I don't even know them now, really. And like, they're all still working to various extents. Like you mentioned, Nicholas Rowe with Holmes. You know, Alan Cox is still working in British theater. He more recently did the John Adams series. He was a part of that show, or miniseries, a while back. And I didn't look up into Sophia's as much. So, yeah, but
I think that she's still, I think they're all still active. She was in Jane Eyre, in the Kiri Joy Fukunawa one in 2011. She's in that.
Okay. All right. Well, there you go. But yeah, I would have liked to have seen more, especially now that I don't really care for origin stories anymore. I don't know if that's just because I'm so jaded by them, or I've just been bombarded by them in most of my youth. But I'm usually more excited once we get the origin stuff out of the way for the, you know, the second or third story. Because like now that we can know who these people are, what do they do now? What do they do now in different circumstances? And I think a sequel would have been interesting for that.
For sure. You know, there was talk of doing a reboot, you know, and trying to make this a franchise a few years ago. I don't know where that's at in development. you know, or if it got sidelined by, you know, Enola Holmes came out earlier this year on Netflix with Millie Bobby Brown, which is it's very much a different thing from this, but I feel like it's going after the same kind of audience and, you know, doing a mystery story for, you know, kind of teenage viewers. But yeah, I think that there's definitely, you know, potential in kind of making Sherlock Holmes more mainstream again. I mean, we had the Robert Downey Jr. movies a few years ago, and they're still supposedly making a third entry of that. But it's interesting because, you know, Sherlock Holmes is one of the most adapted characters of all time. And yet I feel like in terms of, you know, modern films, we really don't see him that much. I mean, we have the BBC series with Benedict Cumberbatch was popular for quite a while, but just in terms of you know, his film presence currently, I feel like, you know, he's kind of been missing in action for a little bit. So I think it'd be cool to see a little bit more.
I think it would be nice too, but I mean, we just finished, I think they just finished the Elementary show with John Lee Miller. And so, I mean, Holmes has not been in and out, and you're right that we have Enola Holmes, but that's a different side of Sherlock Holmes. I mean, I'm all for it. I mean, I'm even for another Downey Jr. and oh God, I'm blanking on the name.
Jude Law.
Jeez. I'm in for another adventure, especially now that they have Dexter Fletcher attached to doing the movie. Because I liked his Rocket Man movie, so
yeah.
I'm interested, but I kind of need this one also too to kind of, you know, get more life, you know, get some more eyes. Too, because I think this is the one out of the retrospective so far that deserves the more attention.
For sure.
All right. So with that, I think we've talked about Young Sherlock Holmes a pretty good bit here, Richard. Do you have anything else to say on the movie before we go?
No. Yeah. I enjoyed watching it. And definitely. In terms of quality, surprised me. I was not expecting to enjoy it as much as I did. It definitely has some goofy stuff and some stuff that doesn't age well, but I'm definitely glad that I got to see it. And I'd watch it again.
Me too. I was rewatching it again as we were getting back before this podcast, just so I can get in the mindset, but mostly to get back in the mindset because I've been Mandalorian on the mind lately, so, as you probably can understand.
Yeah, for sure.
But awesome. So with that, Richard, do you have a book coming out soon?
I do. Yeah. It's a collection of horror stories, of 10 horror stories. The book is called We Make Monsters Here. And it is available. The Kindle copy is available for pre-order currently, and then paperback will be available on February 23rd. So you can go on Amazon and type in We Make Monsters Here and find it. But I'm really excited for people to check it out. You know, writing movies is a passion of mine, but also, you know, writing fiction. So I'm excited to kind of explore that more and, you know, get some of my stories out there.
That's awesome. I, for you listeners, I'll leave it some links in the description to the Kindle and the paperback versions of this. I can't wait. I can't wait to read this book. Richard is a very good writer. We're writing about movies, and I can't wait to read his fiction coming up. And with that, Richard, where can the good people find you?
I am on Twitter at Richard L. Newby. I'm always happy to talk about movies and pop culture. So definitely reach out.
Absolutely. Thank you, Richard, for being on the show today. And you can find me, listeners, at Movie Kale. All of Richard's links will be in the description below. Please check them out. We'll be back very soon for the final part of this retrospective, which is the only Spielberg-directed movie of 85, and that is The Color Purple. Thanks, everyone. We'll be back with you very soon. I don't want to say next week because I don't know when I'll do that episode, but it'll be very soon.
By Barry Levinson.
There's a clever murderer on the loose, and I'm going to find him.
I might get caught, and that would mean trouble.
You would let trouble ruin an opportunity for adventure.
It's only a hallucination. Maybe not.
Oh my God. They're going to kill her.
Stop! She's alive!
Before the legend began,